Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got capital punishment, a police shooting, presidential politics, and much more. And joining me this morning in studio, Tribune Justice reporter Erin Alberty is with us. Hi, Erin.
Hi.
Also with us, investigative reporter Matt Canham is here. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
We have government reporter Chris Smart. Chris, good morning to you.
Good morning.
We have columnist Paul Raleigh. Paul, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And lastly but not least, senior political reporter Robert Gerke is with us. Hi, Robert.
Hi.
And a full house here at KCPW. You are welcome to join us as well. What are you interested in talking about? Lots of news happened this week. We'd love to hear from you. Put your comments at sltrib.com. You can tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. You can also call us, 801-355-TALK is that number. We've got to start out with Mitt Romney. He's been ratcheting up his rhetoric against the GOP presidential frontrunner Donald Trump for some time now. And this week, he let it all out with a sharp-elbowed speech at the University of Utah. Matt, you were there. What did he say?
It was normal Mitt Romney cadence and delivery, but the words were far tougher than anything I'd heard him say before or anyone in the Republican Party say against Donald Trump. Here's one quote. He said, "Here's what I know. Donald Trump is a phony, a fraud. His promises are as worthless as a degree from Trump University. He's playing the American public for suckers. He gets a free ride to the White House, and all we get is a lousy hat." That was one paragraph of an 18-minute speech that was pretty much a point-by-point attack on Donald Trump, everything from his tax plan to his foreign policy to his comments against women, his making fun of a reporter for being disabled. He went point by point about why he does not think Donald Trump should be president.
The crowd loved this. He was speaking before a packed house of students at the University of Utah.
Yeah, the crowd was really enthusiastic. He got a big standing ovation. They kept cheering. There were probably three or four hecklers, Donald Trump supporters, who would tell him to go home or support Donald Trump, and they were immediately shouted down by the crowd. This was an audience of people who already agreed with Mitt Romney, which could be kind of one of the big points of this, is who was Mitt Romney trying to reach? Donald Trump supporters are not going to be turned off on their man by someone from the establishment by Mitt Romney. The majority of people in that crowd already disagreed already agreed with Mitt Romney that Donald Trump should not be president. So who is he going to really sway in this?
Certainly not Donald Trump. Certainly not his supporters.
No.
You reported that there was a white supremacist who did a robocall.
Right. I mean, this kind of shows how amazing this presidential cycle is. Donald Trump has gotten the support of racists and white supremacists. And in one now famous CNN interview, did not denounce a former KKK leader. And Mitt Romney criticized it for it. Well, you had a man named William Johnson, who is the head of the American Freedom Party. He is a white nationalist, which apparently means they want a country for white people only. And he has been going around doing pro-Donald Trump robocalls in states across the nation. And he's done one in Utah. People on Thursday and Friday night will receive phone calls at night at between 6 and 8 on their landlines saying that Trump is a nationalist and a populist and Mitt Romney's mean-spirited.
Raleigh, just as a sidebar to that, your column today cites Donald Trump Jr. appearing on a Utah-based conservative talk show with yet another white supremacist, right?
Yeah, it was a Liberty Roundtable. It's a right-wing radio program. It was founded, I think, in 2005. He was on and was interviewed. The host's name, I believe, is Bushman, but there was another person on there, and they were questioning each other in a very friendly way. And this guy, the other guy, has been cited by the Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate monger, as a racist. This program in the past has had like people well known Holocaust denier, people who are very open about anti-Semitism and and racism. And so Donald Trump Jr. was on in these confines with, in a very friendly way, with these kind of people.
Matt, one thing that there's been a lot of speculation is the timing of Mitt Romney's statement. He spoke after Super Tuesday. Why was now the moment? Did he address that at all with reporters?
He didn't address with reporters, but talking to some of his friends and supporters, you get the sense that part of it was time slipping away, and the Republican Party as a whole really hasn't fought against Donald Trump, and they're now starting to, because if you don't do it now, you're not going to do it at all. He's going to get the nomination. And I think there was a sense that Mitt Romney knew he had a platform since he was the last presidential nominee from that party, and he thought he had to use it now or never. Now, the interesting part is Mitt Romney's not endorsing another Republican candidate. Essentially, he's arguing that none of the Republican candidates can win in a conventional way, that the only way to beat Donald Trump at this point is a brokered convention. And for our listeners who are not up to speed on what a brokered convention would be, in the Republican Party, you need 1,287 delegates to claim the nomination outright through these primaries that are going on now. If no candidate gets that, when you go to the convention, there no one's going to get the nomination in a first ballot, at which point there's negotiations among the party of trying to get to that magic number. And that brokered convention is really rare. The last one in the Republican Party happened in 1948. So when Mitt Romney and Mitt Romney supporters say their goal is a brokered convention, that's a long shot.
Now, Raleigh, you're looking very prescient because you floated this theory in a column last weekend about the brokered convention, about Mitt Romney's intentions to step in if none of the candidates meet the delegate threshold. But here's the question. Could Romney be the consensus candidate? He has had two failed attempts. Can he rally the Republican troops behind him?
You know, I'm not sure that it's realistic, and I'm not sure how realistic the Romney people even believe it is. But I do know that they're looking at that, and that they've talked about it, and that there has been some movement behind the scenes. If nobody wins on the first ballot and it goes, then all the delegates are released and can go wherever they want. And so now you got this open convention in the next ballot or multiple ballots. In order to be placed in nomination, you have to have eight delegations agree to place a candidate in nomination. So so Romney would have to have eight different state or territory delegations vote to place him in nomination. And then if you got like Cruz and Rubio and all these other people, they also need eight, on a second ballot, would need eight delegations to place them in nomination. So that kind of spreads it pretty thin. Like Matt said, it's interesting that Romney didn't endorse anybody, still hasn't, and there was a lot of speculation he was going to endorse Rubio before the Nevada caucuses, and he did not. And so that's when I started making calls and talking to people who are close to Romney, and this is actually something they are looking at, and maybe his speech yesterday was testing the waters to see what kind of reaction or what kind of traction he might be able to get.
Well, talk about the reaction among the establishment, Matt. So did it rally the troops? Did it really light a fire under Mitt's base?
You know, it's interesting because there was a mixed reaction. You had almost instantaneously, you had John McCain, who was the Republican presidential candidate before Mitt Romney in 2008. And he also, it was much more mild, but criticized Donald Trump, encouraged people to look at what foreign policy leaders are saying, what national security experts are saying about Donald Trump before they make their pick. He was also siding with Mitt. But then we saw Governor Herbert at the Capitol yesterday speaking to reporters. He wouldn't go as far as Mitt. He said there were some things he likes about Donald Trump, even though he's a bit of a blusterer. Maybe he would like a little bit more substance. But, you know, it shows that everyone's, you know, a lot of people in the party are one foot in and one foot out.
John Huntsman Jr., what did he say?
John Huntsman Jr. criticized Mitt Romney for what the speech was yesterday. He thought this idea of trying to force a brokered convention is undemocratic, that we have a series of primaries, we should let voters decide who the candidate is, and we should go from there. He thought it was the height of arrogance.
Okay, so if the nominee needs 1,287 delegates to win the nomination, Trump is at 336. Right. That means he has to get 52% here from now on to make it work. So, I mean, that's a heavy lift for anybody.
So there are plenty of people who are very smart to look at these numbers and can get a sense of where people are tracking. Where this becomes complicated is you have to look at each individual state, the demographics of that state, who's popular and who's not. Donald Trump is not popular in Utah. This is probably his worst state. But you take a state like Florida, which is going to vote on March 15th. That's Marco Rubio's home state. A recent poll had Donald Trump up by 20 percentage points. You win Florida, that's a huge chunk of delegates. You win a state like California, it's a huge chunk of delegates. So each state is its own animal. And when you look at it, Mitt Romney, who's obviously a very smart person who's gone through this process twice, says Donald Trump is the only candidate in the race who has a chance to get the nomination before a convention.
Raleigh, it's interesting that Utah's 40 delegates may actually make a difference in this year's race.
Well, yeah. I mean, Utah could probably might have a little more clout than its population justifies. I mean, there are some Utah Republicans who are, you know, have some clout on the national stage. Kurt Bramble is the Senator Kurt Bramble is the president of the NCSL. Herbert, I believe, is still chairman of the National Governors Association. James Evans has been the Republican state chairman has been very active on a national stage, and I know that James Evans has been going around and talking to different delegations about supporting Mitt Romney, the possibility of that in a brokered convention. Just one word about Huntsman and his comments about Romney. I'll just point out that there's a history between those two.
Sure.
And it goes clear back to the Olympics when Romney was chosen to head the committee, the Olympic Committee, over Huntsman. And there was a lot of bitterness about that.
Mormon and, Rivals, I think that book is called.
Yes.
And then when Romney was running against McCain for the Republican nomination in 2008, and Huntsman endorsed McCain, I know that there was a lot of bitterness and hard feelings about that.
Mm. Gerke, how is all of this playing on Utah's Capitol Hill? It comes right in the middle of sort of crunch time for state lawmakers. Was there a lot of chatter about Mitt Romney yesterday?
You know, there is. There are a lot of people who are sort of a lot of consternation, I guess, in some quarters. You know, one of the things you mentioned about Utah potentially mattering, it probably won't matter in picking the winner, but it could matter in denying a winner a win. Is that right? So it's sort of like part of the firewall if there's an anti-Trump firewall. But yeah, up on Capitol Hill, you know, we were talking to Senator Okerlund, who is one of a group of state legislators who came out and supported Donald Trump. And he said that, you know, he doesn't agree with everything he says, but he still thinks the outsider's viewpoint is valuable and that, you know, he's not surprised that the Republican establishment, a.k.a. Mitt Romney, is coming out and you know, going after him the way they are. So, but, you know, and there's this whole other group of people. I mean, I think if you counted noses up there, Rubio's probably the most popular among the state lawmakers, who are sort of almost apoplectic and trying to figure out, you know, what they're going to do. How does this Donald Trump train get derailed? But, you know, they're also fairly helpless to do much about it outside of, you know, campaigning, voting, that sort of thing. So, yeah, people seem to be fairly puzzled by the whole phenomenon.
Did Mitt Romney, Matt, did he say if Trump is the nominee, would he vote for him?
No, and that's an interesting part. I mean, that speech was fascinating what he did say, but also what he didn't. he stopped short of where a lot of where some Republicans have been, where they said they're not going to vote for Donald Trump if he's the Republican nominee. The senator from Nebraska, Ben Sasse, said that recently. Mitt Romney didn't say that. And I talked to Kirk Jowers, who's a friend of his and the former director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah. And Kirk said that there's two reasons for that. One, if you don't vote for Donald Trump, if he's the nominee, you're essentially giving the presidency to the Democrats, which would be Hillary Clinton most likely. And Mitt Romney's not a Hillary Clinton fan. Two, if you do something as the Republican Party that lets a Democrat win, that Democrat can pretty much set the Supreme Court's ideological balance for a generation or more. And for Republicans, that's a hard one to swallow. You know, you're talking about the Second Amendment gun rights or abortion law or rules about unions. If you just don't want the Republican and you undercut that nomination, you're giving that up.
One other thing, I guess, that Gary Herbert talked about yesterday when he was asked about the current state of the presidential field, Mitt Romney's comments, is he had said that, you know, the tone of the debate right now is pretty caustic. I mean, it's reached a level, he compared it to a junior high school food fight, and said that he would like to see it elevated, but he's not sure that that's going to happen given the way that this, given the current trend. I mean, I think we saw in the debate, the presidential debate last night as well, sort of a continued deterioration in sort of the level of dialogue that's been going on.
I suppose that the option of Hillary running against Trump has Utah Democrats salivating. They would love that because they do think that more moderate Republican voters would rather vote for Hillary than for Trump.
Right. And that's what you hear out of the Democrats is not just that, you know, a Trump candidacy will hurt Republicans nationally, but they think locally, in a race like Mia Love's race against Doug Owens, which was close last time, that could swing voters, either keep Republicans home, bring moderate Republicans over to the Democratic side, or energize Democrats, and actually have some effects down ticket, you know, in the congressional races and in state Senate and state House races that have been close traditionally. It could prove a decisive factor. So they're cheering for Trump at this point, I think.
Is that wishful thinking, Paul Raleigh?
Probably, yeah. I mean, it's a Republican district. When we're talking about Mia Love's, it's pretty shifted toward, you know, the Republican side in the last redistricting. So it's going to be an uphill battle for Owens. I know that the National Democratic Committee see that as a possible, you know, possible place that they could pick up a seat. As I recall, I think that Mia Love, you know, most of her votes were you know, Republican, you know, votes were it was just what's the term I'm trying to say, that were just for straight Republican voting. I don't know that she did real well on crossovers, and so if that's true and Republicans stay home because of Trump, you know, that could hurt her because she hasn't shown real strength in having crossovers from people who vote for, you know, maybe Democrats in other races and then her.
Okay, so we've got Florida, Ohio coming up next week. Following week, it's the Utah debate on March 21st. GOP candidates are set to debate here in Utah, Salt Lake City. All systems go?
Yeah, so far, you know, honestly, the Republican Party announced they're going to do a debate here and then went radio silence. The state party hasn't got much information.
Do we
either.
Even know how you get tickets yet?
They haven't, to our knowledge, they have not picked a location yet. So we don't know how many seats there would be at this location, let alone how to get any of those tickets. Now, to the Republican Party's, you know, to throw them a bone, they did have Super Tuesday and two debates recently to keep that that they had to focus on. You'd assume we'll hear some information pretty soon here about what's going on. This will come after the next 10 states vote. So the field could be more narrow than it is now. You know, when I first heard about this debate, people said there could be four candidates, maybe three. Well, we're at four now.
Right.
So we'll see how many actually stay in by March 21st.
Well, and you mentioned Florida coming up, and I believe Michigan.
Michigan is this Tuesday. Florida is the next.
Yeah, and so those are states, Florida that Rubio wants to win, Michigan that Kasich wants to win, and if they don't win those, then there's a chance, as Matt says, the field could be narrowed.
Okay. Lots and lots to watch on the political scene. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in Salt Lake City, throughout the state of Utah on Utah Public Radio. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. Stick around. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Joining me today, Paul Raleigh, Chris Smart, Robert Gerke, Aaron Alberti, and Matt Canham, all of the Salt Lake Tribune. And again, if you want to join our conversation about the week's news, you can tweet to the hashtag TribTalk, comment online, sltrib.com, or give us a call. 801-355-TALK is that number. Let's move on to Utah's Capitol Hill. The legislature is on the downhill side with less than a week to go. And this week, Utah senators weighed in on capital punishment. And Robert, what happened?
Well, capital punishment is not actually the, you know, having to go to the Capitol and cover the legislature every day.
Okay, death penalty.
To clear that up. So the capital punishment bill that Senator Steve Urquhart has been pushing this session, I think maybe somewhat surprisingly, made it through the Senate. They passed it and sent it over to the House, where it's waiting for a committee hearing. The opposition, you know, Senator Urquhart's argument was that, you know, It's not cost effective. We spend more executing people than we do keeping them in prison for life. Government makes mistakes, and we don't want to kill somebody inappropriately. I think he said, until, you know, given that government's not perfect, we should not be in the life and death business, was his quote. And then the argument that, you know, the process, this 20-25 year process of appeals and so forth, really causes problems. It prevents families from moving on and having closure on what they've experienced. So that was his argument. There were arguments on the other side that, you know, Senator Wyler argued that it is cost effective, and that, you know, and there were some who just obviously voted for it based on their sort of their belief that it's a deterrent. But the point is, now it's in the House. It's been assigned to a committee. It's going to the House Law Enforcement Committee, which is a pretty tough committee for it, but they had two bad choices, I think, in between the House Judiciary Committee and the House Law Enforcement Committee. They think they have the votes in the Law Enforcement Committee, or they're hoping, I guess, that they have the votes in the Law Enforcement Committee, and that'll be up for a hearing here shortly.
Raleigh, 19 states have rejected the death penalty. So if this bill is approved, Utah would be the 20th. But as Robert mentioned, the Utah Senate is a very different place from the Utah House. I mean, what kind of reception do you expect during the House deliberation?
Well, it's going to be a lot tougher in the House. And that's true. They are two pretty different bodies. And you've got there's a lot more ideology, I think, at the forefront in the House than in the Senate. I think there's a little more pragmatism in the Senate. I'll just point out that it's interesting that Urquhart, not that long ago, was in favor of the death penalty, and he's talked about this, and he actually, you know, had a lot of discussions. He's a very serious guy. And he's shown a lot of courage, I think, in some of the causes that he's tried to push through. Of course, this is his last session. He's not running for re-election. But he's talked about how he, you know, talked with people and was persuaded to change his mind and be against the death penalty for the reasons that Robert outlined.
Robert, does he have the votes?
Well, it's going to be close. Now, we asked Senator Urquhart this after it passed the Senate, and he said, we're going to pass it. He's very confident. He said he's been approached by House members, people he did not think would ever, you know, he'd ever envisioned having, would actually support this bill. And he says they're on board with it. There is, you know, while it's an ideological divide maybe between the House and the Senate, there's also this sort of strong libertarian streak in the House, and there are some people over there that, you know, that you might not expect to come out and actually support this. So Senator Urquhart's confident. They think they have the votes in the committee, and he says they're gonna pass it in the House. And then the question becomes, what's Governor Herbert gonna do? Because Governor Herbert is a supporter of the death penalty. He said his biggest concern about it is that it doesn't happen fast enough. And so, you know, we asked him yesterday, point blank, you know, are you going to veto it if it comes to your desk? He says he hasn't made a decision on that yet, but did reiterate his support for the death penalty in concept.
I think, as I recall, Speaker Greg Hughes is a supporter of repealing the death penalty.
He is. And I think that gives him a little bit of latitude in terms of, you know, where how the committee process goes for him. And the Speaker has assured Senator Urquhart that he's going to get a fair shake in the House on this, and it'll get a vote.
When is the committee hearing again?
I believe it's going to be early next week. I believe Monday, but I don't think it's been scheduled formally yet.
Okay. It is sort of a beat the clock time. The clock is winding down to Thursday. One bill that did not make it this session, legislation that would have strengthened Utah's hate crime law. It failed in the Senate. What was the intent of the bill, Robert?
Well, again, this is another bill from Senator Urquhart. As Paul mentioned, he's in his last term. He's a little off the leash, I guess, and get doing whatever he feels like he should be doing, I guess. So the hate crimes bill, right now, Utah's had a hate crimes bill on the books for a number of years, but prosecutors have said that it's unenforceable. And so there have been, you know, all of these hate crimes that have been reported, there's never actually been a case filed. So what Senator Urquhart's bill would have done is basically give the state a law that can be enforced if you commit a crime against somebody based on their race, religion, you know, sexual orientation, gender identity. You know, you get bumped up from, you know, a misdemeanor to a felony, or from a second to a first degree felony. So that's it gives an enhancement for crimes against these protected groups. And so the argument, the contention on you know, the from Senator Urquhart and from supporters was that when you do commit a crime against these people based on these factors, it's an act of terror, basically, that you're trying to terrorize the entire group of those people and not just that one individual. Opponents, of course, argued that, well, this is going after the thought, the intent, or the thought behind what's motivating these people. And so that's and you know, Governor Herbert and others have said this, that, you know, if you commit a crime against somebody, it's always motivated by hate. It's not you know, it's not necessarily, you know, if you beat somebody up because you're just looking to beat somebody up, it's no different than doing it because they're gay or whatever. So that bill failed. Senator Urquhart and others laid the blame for that squarely at the feet of the Mormon Church. The church had come out earlier in the session and said that, you know, last year the legislature passed an anti-discrimination ordinance that prevented discrimination against LGBT individuals in housing and the employment. So the church said, well, we passed that last year. We don't need to do anything else this year. We don't want to see more back and forth tug of war over this. And so they asked that basically there be a detente this session. And before the church came out with a statement, Senator Urquhart said he had the votes lined up. At least three votes switched, and the bill failed. It got 12 votes. It would have had 13. So he was up around 16 votes before the church statement came out, if his count is accurate. So, you know, so he's and he said the other thing it did is not just change the votes, but it also people stopped talking about it. It was the church had spoken, the dialogue, the time for discussion was over, and the decisions were made. And so that's why he'd been working the bill for a week and a half or so since it got out of committee. And he just said, you know what, well, we'll bring it up for a vote, because he knew it was going to fail when he brought it up and had the debate.
The LGBT community took this as a pretty hard defeat.
It is. I mean, you know, I think if you look at the history of the anti-discrimination bill, for example, it had been up there a number of years before it passed. I think this time they were hopeful because it did have the backing of so many people in law enforcement and prosecutors and the Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice. And, you know, all of these groups had kind of come together and said, this is a bill we need. And then, you know, to have it sort of get blown up the way it did and come up short, I think was a blow for them. Others have, you know, as we mentioned, this is Senator Urquhart's last year, but others have said that they will sponsor this bill next year and they'll get it through eventually.
Just very briefly, a measure by Senator Jim DeBacchus to rename Columbus Day also rejected. What happened to Indigenous Peoples Day?
Well, it was a fiery debate. So it was kind of funny because they had the death penalty bill that came up, and there was very little discussion about that one, actually. Indigenous Peoples Day comes up, and there were fireworks, you know. Senator Backus says that, you know, Utah's had these Indian populations, these American Indian populations that were predated, obviously, the pioneers and Father Escalante and all these people. And he said it makes more sense to honor these indigenous peoples on this Columbus Day holiday than it does to honor Christopher Columbus. And you know, the pushback was pretty fierce. I think Senator Christensen called Columbus a great American hero. Senator Wyler was particularly adamant about sort of the fact that, you know, Columbus has been tagged as a genocidal monster, and he, you know, it was disease and things like that that actually killed the native populations. And so, you know, and Senator Escamilla on the Democratic side said that, you know, it's there are a number of cities that have gone this route. I don't think any states have gone this route, but the reason they do it is because Columbus is seen as somebody who wiped out these populations and not something to be celebrated. So the bill ultimately failed. I'm not sure that anybody was necessarily surprised by it. Before it even got debated, Senator DeBacchus wanted to try to schedule it for a time certain, is what they call it. Schedule a firm time to debate the bill, because there were a bunch of American Indian representatives who wanted to be there to hear the debate.
And you can see the despondency on their faces in the pictures at slturb.com.
Yeah, and they wouldn't give them that. So yeah, that bill failed, and I'm not sure that, given the dynamic of this legislature, I'm not sure anybody was surprised. One interesting thing, Senator Stevenson actually proposed making it Columbus/Indigenous Peoples Day, sort of trying to, you know, kind of go both ways, and even that was defeated fairly soundly.
We've got to move on, but just recap for us, what is on tap for the legislature's final days?
Yeah, down the stretch, as we mentioned, we've got the death penalty bill. Medical marijuana will be coming up in the House next week. They released their first crack at the budget yesterday, and there's going to be more discussion of that today and through next week. There's a ton of education bills that are making their way through and kind of sometimes going in different directions even. So those are sort of the highlights, I think, that we'll be watching closely.
Medicaid?
The Medicaid expansion is going to be this Representative Dunnigan bill that just targets the homeless, the mentally ill, and those people who are just out of jail. It covers about 16,000 people, and it's going to cost about $100 million, and it seems to be the only train that's going to leave the station. Although Democrats yesterday did make another push for full Medicaid expansion that they've done for the last several years without any success.
Okay. Well, good luck during the home stretch, and we'll watch your reporting very closely. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Let's move on to Salt Lake City politics and a tragic shooting that occurred in the capital city. This happened last Saturday. Has the community pressing the police department about its use of force policy. And Aaron, you've been covering this. What do we know about what happened Saturday night?
Well, not actually a ton. We know that a 17-year-old boy was shot by police. After the shooting occurred, there were a lot of people nearby. This happened over on Rio Grande near the homeless shelter. There's always a lot of people out and about there. Some people in the crowd became angry with the police after the shooting. There were rocks and bottles thrown by some of the people. The officers called for reinforcements, and about 100 officers from different agencies turned up, some of them with riot shields and assault rifles for crowd control. The crowd eventually dispersed, and then the next day the police department said that the officers were in the area on an unrelated call when they were alerted to an assault in progress, is what how they described it, saying that the boy who was shot, along with another person, had metal objects and they were attacking a third victim. When they said to drop the weapons, the boy, they said, instead advanced on the victim.
Now, both of the officers who were involved in this shooting were wearing body cams, but we haven't seen that video yet. Why is the city withholding?
Well, the city says that they're withholding the video because under a new law, outside agencies are required to investigate deadly force incidents. So Unified Police are conducting the investigation. So Salt Lake City Police say the body cam footage is UPD's evidence now, and so they're not in a position to release it. Also, Sim Gill came out last night and said that he was not going to release it, and he's asked the other agencies not to release it either, saying that it could compromise the investigation in some way. This has left the family not very happy. They want to see the body cam, particularly because a friend who was with Abdullahi, the teenager, at the time, has said that there was no third victim that she saw. The two people with the metal objects had actually broken a lightweight broomstick in half and were fighting with each other. She was trying to break up the fight. And when that's what was going on when the police arrived, she said that she called out the boy's name and he was turning toward her when the police shot him.
Well, so everybody is sort of clamoring for this video. Officials not willing to release it quite yet. You mentioned that there was sort of this spontaneous response from the crowd, essentially protesting what they had seen. On Monday, hundreds of people marched down Main Street to protest the shooting. And then on Wednesday night, Salt Lake City officials held a listening session, a community meeting to discuss things. Chris, what happened at that meeting?
Okay, so this is something called the Salt Lake City Human Rights Commission that we don't hear much about. It's a group of volunteers who are interested in human rights. And they were joined by Police Chief Mike Brown, David Litbeck from Mayor Biskupski's office, and Councilman James Rogers. About 100 people came, and they were invited to address the group. And it was an emotional scene with the victim's girlfriend and other friends wondering why this young man was shot. He was not threatening police. It happened very fast, as these things do. They didn't understand that. They don't understand why the video is not being released. And
how did the chief respond to these pointed questions?
The chief responded, as Aaron did, in terms of releasing the video. But he kept saying, and he, you know, Mike Brown was staring into the face of the dragon, and he was very calm, and he's has a great bedside manner. And he was trying to explain that he couldn't discuss the specifics of this incident at the time, but that his officers all go through this de-escalation training. Those words were falling flat because in this instance, perhaps more than the two fatal police shootings in the last couple of years, in this instance, it just didn't seem like the officers tried to de-escalate at all, and that they according to this witness that Aaron's talking about, they said, drop your weapon. And within a second, shot him because he didn't drop it. We don't know. There's a lot we don't know. That's just one version of the story.
Sure, sure.
We'll find out at some point what actually happened. But the fact that folks don't know what happened has them angry. It has them frustrated and frightened. So many of the folks at this meeting were people of color, and they live, on the West Side and in other places around downtown, and they are fearful of police, and they let that be known. And this is the great thing about this, though, I think, was that the Human Rights Commission, unlike the two fatalities I discussed, invited the community to come and vent. The crowd was very well behaved, unlike other town halls that we've seen where there was shouting and name calling. This crowd was very well behaved, but they did make their points one after another, and it was all pretty similar.
Hmm. Paul Raleigh, Mayor Jackie Biskupski has been in office about 3 months now.
Well, no, about two and a half,
yeah. I guess. This appears to be her first real test. And she campaigned on transparency. What's your assessment? How's she doing?
Well, from my perspective, she's not doing all that well right now. And this you're right, this is probably her first test as far as being transparent. And she was, she campaigned on that. I understand she walked out of a radio interview when they were trying to discuss this. She won't come on your trip talk to talk about this. Aaron talked about, their explanation why they're not releasing the body cam, but I'm not so sure that they've done that adequately, explain that. And Chris Burbank, the former police chief, has been outspoken about how they should release it, and he was all for transparency and these sorts of things, and he's been critical of what's going on right now.
Chris, any thoughts to add there?
Well,
on the mayor's response.
Well, okay, so the mayor put out a press release of her own following the shooting, and it was hard to understand exactly what she was driving at, but it almost seemed critical of police. And then she went on this KSL radio show that Paul mentioned. And so the host asked her, did you see the video before you wrote this? And she said, yes. He says, well, what's in the video? He says, well, it's under investigation. I can't comment. And so the host kept asking her the same question in several different ways. And then after about three of those, she said, I gotta go, rather than, trying to explain again that she couldn't comment. So, but the overarching issue remains in terms of when do police use lethal force. We're not making progress.
I would say just this is kind of off topic, but there are a couple bills up at the Capitol going on right now. One is that one would expand this de-escalation training to departments across the state. Salt Lake City, as Chris mentioned, has it for every one of their patrol officers, I think. The other one is a sort of a statewide standard for body cameras and also access to the footage from body cameras that is pending now in the Senate. And is one that's been pretty hotly debated, frankly, between law enforcement, between media that wants access, and between legislators.
Well, we're certainly going to continue to follow this. It is a very important topic, but we have to take another break. We're talking about Utah's top stories. We need to scoot for a moment. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Time for our underplayed story of the week, our final segment. And Aaron, kick us off. What's your pick?
Nate Carlisle had a story earlier this week about the fact that in the recent food stamp fraud case against members of the FLDS Church, they've charged two women among the 11 defendants. This is unusual because, as he writes in the story, typically women in these polygamous communities are seen as victims and as not really having very much power. So they typically are kind of excused from criminal prosecution. In this case, this hasn't happened. The two women that were charged are accused of helping to orchestrate this from inside stores that allegedly processed the funds. They co-owned the stores with their husbands. So that's unusual for some of these cases.
And some fantastic reporting from Nate Carlisle. If you haven't seen it, sltrib.com. Check it out. Matt Canham, what's your pick?
Annie Knox has a story today about Salt Lake Community College agreeing that if you get a Pell Grant, they will pay the rest of your tuition and fees. That could mean up to 14,000 students could get a community college two-year degree for absolutely nothing, which is big news, and it will start in the fall.
Bernie Sanders has been campaigning here, apparently. What?
All right.
Chris Smart, what's your underplayed story?
Well, there's been a Gladys Knight sighting. Gladys Knight, the soul singer, was in a car driving to an LDS choir practice when the car was pulled over by a cop for speeding. So what happened, to make a long story short, it turned out it was the cop's birthday. And his wife was riding along with him. And when Gladys Knight heard that, she burst into happy birthday and sang this cop the song. This is in Pleasant Grove. Now, I don't know what bearing that had on the citation. But I would invite all your listeners, the next time they get pulled over, to sing happy birthday.
Try it out. Yeah. That's great. Love the moral of the story. Paul Raleigh, what's your pick?
Well, we had a story on the sports page earlier this week, but I think that this needs more attention. We had a charter school, Summit Academy, that won the championship, the 2A championship down in, it was in Sevier County, the tournament. And they have two or three African-American players, a couple of Latinos. And both during and after the game, they were harassed. People were yelling racial slurs at them, calling the N-word. Then after the game, and that was the semifinal that they won, they were at a Maverick near their hotel, and they got harassed again. And cars were stopping and threatening them, and they ran back to the hotel, and the coaches and the school officials wrote a police report. But this was at the same time that the legislature has shot down, you know, hate crimes bills. That this is going on, and some of the school officials say that this is typical in rural Utah when they go down there and they get this kind of racial harassment.
You're absolutely right. That deserves a lot more coverage. And Robert, very quickly.
Very quickly. They killed the Tesla bill yesterday. This is a bill that would have let the Tesla automaker start selling its cars in Utah. Right now they're prohibited from doing that because you have to contract with a dealership. The manufacturers have to contract with a dealership. And so after 15 years of negotiation on this, it looks like there's not going to be a bill this year, and Tesla's still
going to
be restricted.
I was just poised to buy the Tesla.
I know.
Robert
I already got
Gerke,
mine.
Paul Raleigh, Matt Canham, Aaron Alberti, Chris Smart, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We'll wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby talks his scale of pain.
There are actual official pain indexes where they will, you know, try to measure your pain based on the feedback that you get. You can't just ask somebody, does it hurt? Because they're going to say, oh, hell yeah, it hurts.
Right.
Or no, it doesn't hurt, even though it might. And so there are even pain indexes where they can measure babies' pain based on their body movements.
Wow.
You know, and how they are acting, whether they're really hurting or not. But I came up with my own, and
It has a creative acronym.
When it comes to measuring my own pain, I use the DAPS, or Dumbass Pain Scale, because it's what I'm most familiar with.
Well, I think it goes through 10 elements of pain. Maybe you can start halfway and read part of this column.
Okay. A level 5 DAPS, pain level would be like a habanero pepper juice enema.
Ooh.
Yeah, that would hurt. A federal audit or cutting your own hair with a belt sander. 6 on that scale would be that thing with Oprah and the golf shoes, where Oprah would jump up and down on you in a pair of golf shoes, or getting sat upon by a flatulent camel. 7 is divorce, a canceled hockey season, or being struck by a motorcycle, piano, or cow while completely sober. There's factored into these, obviously, are physical pain and emotional pain. 8, having your feet nailed gun to the floor of a room in a house which is either on fire or belongs to Mike Tyson. 9, polka. 10, being shot with a taser or hearing your spouse ask, where have you been, when she already knows.
How many of these have you experienced? A few?
I've shot myself with a nail gun. I've been tasered twice by the cops. Once for a class I was going through, and another time just for a joke that I didn't appreciate. A canceled hockey season I've experienced, being struck by a motorcycle. I've never cut my hair with a belt sander. I have never done that.
All right, all right. That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can find all the Kirby archives online, sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW, UPR, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Bennett Purser at UPR, and Emily Means from the Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll be back next week.